the 2015 Rogue River Bible School Day 3. Our first speaker is Brother Roger Lewis. His class subject is The House of Asaph, Family of Faith, Masters of Music. And his class title for today is The Spirit of the House of Asaph. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning, my dear brothers and sisters. In our previous session, we looked at the Psalms of the House of Asaph just briefly, and the purpose, of course, of that study was really to illustrate that we felt that those Psalms had been written not all by Asaph himself, but certainly by members of his family down through time. And we remarked on the wonder of that very circumstance that Almighty God was pleased to grant successive revelations of his purpose to this one family down through time. They were clearly so close to the Father that revelations were given through members of this family over their successive generations. And you'll remember also we discovered how they were left alone to sing before the ark. For a period of 40 years, they pondered the significance of what it was that they were doing. And we believe, as we suggested, is that during those crucial years, they made a leap in their understanding concerning the significance of the ark and the significance of what it meant to come before the presence of God. That in fact, they found that wherever they were, in fact, no matter where they were, that one can live in the very presence of God and certainly ascend before him in the matters of worship and praise. They'd understood the secret of the psalm that David had given to their family, and they would guard that secret for the rest of the nation down through time, forever bringing them back to the central thinking of that idea which constitutes acceptable worship in every generation. It's important to remember, therefore, that our music and our songs of praise are not to be considered acceptable because we like them, or because we like the music, or because we like the rhythm. The only music and the only songs which are acceptable are those that conform to the requirements of God himself. The only music of worship that's acceptable is that which the Father himself delights in. And in order to know whether the Father delights in it, we must need to understand the principles by which he has laid down that we might come before him acceptably in worship. This is the secret that this family will show for us. Now, during that 40 years, those very 40 years where they sang alone before the ark, we believe that Asaph was involved in another activity with David. Because during those years, perhaps towards the end of David's life, we suggest, there was a great deal of activity for the preparation of the temple system of worship that, of course, could only be brought into being once the house of God had been built in the days of Solomon. But long before Solomon built the house, David, in collaboration with Asaph, we believe, had already organized the structure of the system of temple worship. And in fact, that structure was modeled on the theme of the 24 courses. And we're not going to look at these passages because it's all laid out in a sequence of chapters in the First of Chronicles. But what we're told in the First of Chronicles chapter 24 is that there were 24 courses of priests chosen to execute the priestly office. We're told in the First of Chronicles chapter 24 as well that there were 24 courses of Levites who would wait on the service of the priests and on the service of the house of God. In the First of Chronicles 25, we will discover that there were 24 courses of singers to give thanks and to give praise as every day's work required. In the First of Chronicles chapter 26, we're going to find that there were 24 courses of porters that would guard the holy sanctuary and the thresholds of the temple. And in the First of Chronicles, chapter 27, we will find that there are effectively 24 courses of rulers over both the months and the tribes. Everything was modelled on the principle of 24, you see. And isn't it interesting that when we come to the book of Revelation and to the time of the future and the work of our Lord Jesus Christ, is we will find there that there are 24 elders close to the throne in the book of Revelation. And when we look at the work of the elders in the book of Revelation, we will find that they display aspects of the priests and aspects of the singers and aspects of the rulers. And we suddenly realise that all of that organization in the book of Revelation is modeled on what happened in the days of David, when all the system of temple worship was to be organized. We believe that Asaph collaborated with the king in these matters, and that in fact it was during that time that not only were the singers appointed, and we'll look at chapter 25 of the First of Chronicles a little later, but that during these same years, Asaph was busy organizing the music and the hymns that would be used in the system of temple worship. And that really brings us, therefore, to that moment of time when the temple was built. If we come forward now, 40 years from when David established the role of Asaph and his family in the First of Chronicles chapter 16, we're going to come forward 40 years now to that moment, that special moment when in fact Solomon had built the temple and it was now about to be dedicated. And in order to do that, we've got to come to the Second of Chronicles chapter 5, where that story is. But in time we have moved from the First of Chronicles 16 to the Second of Chronicles chapter 5, and in doing so we've come 40 years down the timeline of this family, from about BC 1000, when David first appointed Asaph, to now BC 960, which was the approximate time for the dedication of the Temple of Solomon. And that record is given to us, as we've said, in the Second of Chronicles chapter 5. So in the first few verses, in fact, first 10 verses, we're told about the record of the way in which Solomon assembled the whole nation for this special occasion. And we're told in verse 5 that they brought up the ark from the tabernacle that was in Gibeon, of course, and now they were going to bring the ark into the most holy of the temple that had now been completed. So you see what it says in verse 11 of the record. Verse 11 says, "And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, for all the priests that were present were sanctified, and did not then wait by course." See that word course? That's the 24 courses that we've just made mention of. There were 24 courses of priests. But on this occasion, on the day of the dedication of the temple, they didn't wait in their 24 courses. They were all there together as one glorious multitude of priests on this occasion. Not just the course set down for that week, but all 24 sets of serving priests were present at this great assembly. And as with the priests, so with the singers. Because verse 12 says, "Also the Levites, which were the singers, all of them, see what the reference is, of Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun with their sons and their brethren, being arrayed in white linen, having cymbals and psalteries and harps, they also stood at the east end of the altar, and with them 120 priests sounding with trumpets." And so this was such a special moment, so important an event, that all 24 courses now of the singers are all combined together. Now you realize what this means in verse 12. It means in reality that the sons of Heman and the sons of Jeduthun are now joined with the sons of the house of Asaph for the first time in 40 years to sing before the ark. They've never done this before. This is the first time they will be gathered together. Oh, and did you notice what the record says? Who's mentioned first? It says the Levites, the singers, all of them of Asaph, Heman, and Jeduthun. So you see, the house of Asaph is mentioned first. And I believe that that's the case because their time alone in ministering before the ark for the previous 40 years gave them the primacy amongst the singers. And on this occasion, when they're going to celebrate the very bringing of the ark into the most holy place, it will be this family, this household, that will lead all the 24 courses of singers in the song of praise on this occasion. And you notice one more thing from verse 12. It says the Levites were the singers, all of them of Asaph. You see, I think that quite possibly Asaph himself might have been dead. If he was collaborating with David at least 40 years before, he may not have been alive at the moment of this consecration of the temple. We can't be sure, we're not told. But what we do know is that those of his family were there, they of Asaph were there, and they were there at the forefront of this particular assembly. Yes, from this time forth, as we mentioned in the first of Chronicles, chapter 16, the house of Asaph would always be at the forefront of the matter of worship amongst all the singers. Now just picture that scene for a moment. Verse 12. Here's the assembled choir. They're all robed in white linen. They're all standing with their backs to the altar in this vast semicircle, and they're all facing towards the front of the temple. They can see the pillars, Jachin and Boaz, and they're all standing waiting, and the trumpeter's with them. And the chief musician is there, and he's about to lift his hand, but he will not lift his hand so that the praise might begin until a certain event occurs. He's waiting, verse 11, he's waiting for the priests to emerge from the holy place. Because when they saw the priests first coming out of that door, they would know at that moment that the ark of God was now in the most holy. And when they knew the ark was in its appointed resting place, that would be the signal for the chief musician to lift up his hand, and the choir would be ready to burst forth into the joyous song of praise that they would offer on this day at the dedication of the temple. It must have been a marvelous moment. Can you imagine everyone just waiting, the whole congregation, waiting for that choir, who in turn were waiting for the chief musician to lift his hand that that song might begin on this special day. And verse 13 says, it came to pass, as the trumpeters and singers were as one, to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking Yahweh. Do you notice the two key words again? Praise and thanks. That's from the first of Chronicles, chapter 16, remember, in verse 4. He appointed certain to thank and praise God. Well, here they are. It's the house of Asaph at the forefront of this particular matter. And you see what the record says, verse 13. Did you notice the song they sang? Came to pass, as the trumpeters and singers were as one, to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking Yahweh. And when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets and cymbals and instruments of music, they praised Yahweh, saying, "For he is good, for his mercy endureth forever." Now, where does that song come from? Why, that's the first of Chronicles, chapter 16 and verse 34. Oh, give thanks unto Yahweh, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever. They were singing, brothers and sisters, they were singing the family psalm of the house of Asaph, and they were led by that family in the singing of that song of praise on this occasion. But all 24 courses of singers took their cue, took their spirit from the house of Asaph, who led them all in praise on this magnificent day. Do you notice, just coming back to verse 11, that there's a section in this chapter that's bracketed? You see how it says, verse 11, it came to pass when the priests would come out of the holy place, and then suddenly there's a colon, and then a bracket begins. And that bracket goes to the end of verse 12. It's like a section in parenthesis, you see. It's almost as if it says, well, the priests came out, and then before it carries on telling us what happened, it says, oh, I must just tell you about what did happen and who was there and the singers and the orders, and then it comes back to the subject again in verse 13. And it's almost like a bracketed section in verse 13 as well, because if you come down to the middle of verse 13, you notice it says that they were to make one sound in praising and thanking Yahweh, and when, and then later on in that verse it says, that then the house was filled with a cloud. When they lifted up their voice, then the house was filled with a cloud. Now, it's true that the word then is in italics, but the sense of that word is there because of the context of the phrase. When they lifted up their voice, that the house was, at that moment, filled with a cloud. Now, let me just read that section to you, just observing the force of those brackets, because I think there's a tremendous lesson that emerges from the story of this song of praise led by the house of Asaph on this occasion. So coming back to verse 11, let's just read that and jump over the bracketed section. Verse 11, it came to pass when the priests were come out of the holy place. Verse 13, it came even to pass, as the trumpeters and singers were as one sound, when they lifted up their voice, then the house was filled with a cloud, even the house of Yahweh. Do you know what this whole section is telling us? It tells us that the action of the priests in physically bringing the ark into the most holy was not as significant as the action of the singers in mentally drawing near to God. It wasn't the priests bringing the ark into the sanctuary that drew down the divine glory of God's presence. It was the singers singing with their understanding of what the ark stood for with united hearts. They believed they had entered into the very presence of God, and God sealed his approval of their spirit by the flashing forth of the majesty of the Shekinah glory, and God was enthroned upon the praises of his people. It was the singers, brothers and sisters, the singers, not the priests. They knew how to come into the very presence of God, and God approved that spirit, said, I can bless that. And the glory of God appeared in that house to fill it on this occasion, because when the singers sang, the record says, then the house was filled with the glory of God. You know, that very phrase, the glory of God, that's mentioned in verse 4, the house was filled, verse 14, the house was filled with the glory of Yahweh. It's really strongly reminiscent of an early occasion that you might remember in the divine record. Do you remember how on the day that the Aaronic priesthood was consecrated, in Leviticus 9, verse 23 to chapter 10, verse 3, it says the glory of God filled the house, the glory of God filled the tabernacle. It was the same sort of sense, really. And yet on the very day that the glory of God filled the house on that occasion, we know that two foolish young men went forth with strange fire to offer incense unto God. And there was the flashing forth of the fire of judgment upon Nadab and Abihu. And I'm sure that those that would recollect that earlier episode in the history of Israel, in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 5, they would be aware that there had been an earlier occasion when the glory of God had appeared, but also the flaming fire of his judgment. And the one thing I think we can be certain of with regard to the spirit of these singers in the day of Solomon's consecration is there would be no presumptuous spirit amongst these singers. These who sang would show the highest standard of reverence and dignity in the spirit of exalted thought and worship. Reverence of word and dignity of beat. The whole focus was on that which was reverential before our Heavenly Father. And we know that because if you come to the next chapter in the second of Chronicles chapter, sorry, the two chapters over, second of Chronicles chapter 7, do you see what the record says in chapter 7? On this same occasion, in verse 1, it says, when Solomon had made an end of praying, the fire came down from the heaven, consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifice. The glory of Yahweh filled the house. The priests could not enter into the house of Yahweh because of the glory that had filled Yahweh's house. And when the children of Israel saw how the fire came down and how the glory of Yahweh was upon the house, they bowed themselves with their faces to the ground upon the pavement and worshipped and praised Yahweh, saying, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever. You see, the whole congregation bowed in reverential awe before Almighty God with their faces to the pavement, it says, and they took for their song the song of the house of Asaph. The song of the singers was sung by the people and sung with the same reverence, the same solemnity, as no doubt the singers themselves had already shown before the congregation on this day. Oh yes, there was something very solemn about this song on this day. When people are so smitten with the majesty of God that they sing and worship with their faces to the ground, you can be sure that it's reverential. And that was the spirit that happened on this day, you see, when the Ark of God was taken into the most holy place. And who led that? Who captured that spirit? Who guided the nation in that way? I think the house of Asaph were at the very forefront of what made that occasion, so special and so marvelous. Well, after Solomon came other kings, and as we just briefly survey, since we're in the book of 2 Chronicles, if we just survey the next two or three kings, you can feel certain that the house of Asaph would have been deeply involved in the subsequent kings and the record of their reigns as they unfolded, because of their commitment to the sanctuary and to the things of Almighty God in that place, the place where the Ark of God was. See what it says concerning the second of Chronicles chapter 11, which is the reign of Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. Second of Chronicles chapter 11 says this in the reign of Rehoboam. It says in verse 13, the priests and the Levites that were in all Israel resorted to him out of all their coasts. For the Levites, verse 13, when it says they resorted to him out of all their coasts, Rodahim says they took their stand with him. They took their stand with Rehoboam. Because what was going up to the north with Jeroboam was the introduction of not only a rival, but a completely apostate system of worship. The Levites would none of that. They said, no, we won't associate with that. We take our stand with Rehoboam. And verse 14 says the Levites left their suburbs and their possession and came to Judah and Jerusalem, for Jeroboam and his sons had cast them off from executing the priest's office unto Yahweh, and he ordained them priests for the high places and for the devils and for the calves which he'd made. And after them, after the Levites, verse 14, out of all the tribes of Israel, such as set their hearts to seek Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, came to Jerusalem to sacrifice unto Yahweh, Elohim of their fathers, and they strengthened the kingdom of Judah. And during that time, we see that the Levites and all that were faithful, all that were spiritual, flocked to the sanctuary. That's where the house of Asaph would be. We know that's the case. They would be singing before the ark every evening and every morning as every day's work required. And there was a time, at least for 3 years, as verse 17 says, where the kingdom of Rehoboam flourished mightily in spiritual things. Oh yes, the house of Asaph would have been there, right at the center of what was going on at that time. And I think likewise in the reign of Abijah who followed. Because if you come to the second of Chronicles chapter 13, Abijah, who was in fact the son of Rehoboam, well, there was a similar sort of spirit, really, even in his day. Because we're told in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 13, and verse 10, that Abijah says, he says, "As for us, Yahweh is our God. We've not forsaken him. And the priests which minister unto Yahweh are the sons of Aaron, and the Levites wait upon their business." He's saying this, by the way, in speech to the rebellious house that lies to the north. Those, verse 9, who've cast out the priests of Yahweh, the sons of Aaron and the Levites. "We've not forsaken them," says Abijah in verse 10. In our kingdom are the sons of Aaron and the Levites that wait upon their business. And you know, one of the Levites, or one of the groups of Levites, verse 10, that were waiting upon their business were the singers, including the house of Asaph. And we know that that's the case, because when did the house of Asaph sing? They sang, and I've been careful to say this each time, I think, they sang every evening and every morning. Of course, in terms of the reckoning of a day according to the labors of mankind, it was every morning and every evening. But from the spiritual cycle of God, it was every evening and every morning. And that just happens to be verse 11, the time when they burn unto Yahweh every morning and every evening burnt sacrifices and sweet incense. That's when the song was sung, by the way. Every morning they burnt a lamb. Every evening they burnt a lamb. Every morning they burnt incense. Every evening they burnt incense. Every morning they sang praise. Every evening they sang praise. Do you notice the connection between all those things? A burnt offering, olah, which ascends skywards as a perfume of dedication. Sweet incense, which is burned and ascends to heaven as the incense of prayer. And with those two things, a song of praise consumed from the hearts of the singers who send their words and thoughts aloft through sound, that it also might ascend to the Father as a sweet smelling savour. Those things were done every evening and every morning at the place of the sanctuary, before the Ark of God. Oh, yes, I think the house of Asaph were there in the days of Abijah. And likewise in the days of Asa, because he's the next king. And in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 15, there's a similar spirit in the days of Asa, because we're told in 2nd Chronicles 15 and verse 12, in his days, the record says that they entered into a covenant to seek Yahweh Elohim of their fathers with all their heart and all their soul, that whosoever would not seek Yahweh Elohim of Israel should be put to death, whether small or great, whether man or woman. And they swear unto Yahweh with a loud voice and with shouting and with trumpets and with cornets. And all Judah rejoiced at the oath, for they had sworn with all their heart and sought him with their whole desire, and he was found of them, and Yahweh gave them rest round about. Can you imagine the house of Asaph joining in that covenant of dedication to God? Oh, I can see them doing that. I can see them participating in that oath of dedication and zeal and fervent commitment. And so during these kings who subsequently followed on from Solomon after the dedication of the house, we can see how the house of Asaph would have been there and deeply involved in all that was going on in the system of worship that was to be seen at the sanctuary of God in Jerusalem. And the next king? Why, the next king is where our story now takes us to, because the next king, of course, is Jehoshaphat. And that brings us to the 2nd of Chronicles and chapter 20. And to that day, you remember the day of the confederacy that came against Jehoshaphat. And you'll remember that we believe a psalm was written by a member of the house of Asaph. Psalm 83 was written at that time, captures the very spirit and crisis of the battle of the 2nd of Chronicles and chapter 20. Someone from the house of Asaph wrote a psalm, we believe, on that day. And they cried at the end of that psalm that Yahweh might answer the cries of his people, not so that they might be saved, but that his name might be magnified, and that God answered that prayer, because when the Confederacy was overthrown, we were told, were we not, that the fear of Yahweh was upon all the nations round about when they saw that he fought for his people, in answer to the very prayer of a man of the house of Asaph. And when we come to this story, you see, in the 2nd of Chronicles in chapter 20, we've come now 100 years further along in history from the moment when Solomon dedicated the temple. And if therefore there are members of the house of Asaph in this story that we're going to see in the reign of Jehoshaphat, then we can reasonably assume that the singers that might sing on this occasion are not the same singers that sang at the time of the dedication of the temple. They would be, at the very least, their grandsons and quite possibly their great-grandsons. It's the same family, but it's at least 2 or 3 generations later on in that same family when we come to the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 20. So you remember what the theme of this chapter is, that there was a crisis, the crisis of the Confederacy that was brought against Judah and Jehoshaphat. Now I want you to see the spirit of Jehoshaphat's prayer on this occasion, because it's an absolutely superb prayer, and it's a prayer that I believe demonstrates the very spirit of the house of Asaph itself. See what verse 5 says. 2 Chronicles 20 verse 5, Jehoshaphat stood in the congregation of Judah and Jerusalem in the house of Yahweh before the new court and said. I want you to notice the focus of his prayer. O Yahweh Elohim of our fathers, art not thou God in heaven, and rulest not thou over all the kingdoms of the heathen, and in thine hand is there not power and might, so that none is able to withstand thee? Did you see how that prayer began? It's all about thou and thy and thine. It's not about me and my and mine. Did you notice that crucial, vital difference? The nation is in crisis, but the focus of the king is about God's honor, God's purpose, God's direction. You see, that's what God-centered thinking is all about, that even in our worst moments, we still realize that the focus is about the ultimate purpose of God and not ourselves. And this man stands up and he prays this marvelous prayer that showed that he understood that spirit and that principle. Verse 7, art not thou our God, who didst drive out the inhabitants of this land before thy people Israel and gavest it to the seed of Abraham, thy friend, forever? And they dwelt therein, and have built thee a sanctuary therein for thy name, saying, if when evil cometh upon us as the sword, judgment, or pestilence, or famine, we stand before this house and in thy presence, for thy name is in this house, and cry unto thee in our affliction, then thou wilt hear and help. Do you know where he's quoting from? He's quoting from the very prayer of Solomon at the time of the dedication of the temple, 100 years before. That's what Solomon said, is that in the time of their affliction, if they turned to the temple and to the presence of God and prayed before God at that time, before this house, God would hear them in their worst and most difficult times of crisis. And Jehoshaphat, 100 years later, captures the very spirit of Solomon's cry at the dedication of the temple. Ooh, but did you see the key word? Verse 9. If when these things come, we stand panim, in the presence of this house, and in thy panim, in thy presence. Do you remember that was the key word in the Psalm of the House of Asaph in the first of Chronicles 16? In thy presence, in thy presence, in thy presence, in thy presence. That's the word Jehoshaphat uses here. When we come before thee, into thy very presence, as it were. And he noticed, he already had recognized the spirit of the House of Asaph, which had long since figured out this particular conundrum. Because you see what Jehoshaphat says, verse 6. He says in verse 6, art not thou God in heaven? And yet he also recognizes that the God, verse 6, who dwells in heaven is also seen to be in the house on earth that bears his name. Verse 9, God dwells in heaven, God dwells in the sanctuary. That's the theme of the very Psalms of the House of Asaph. This man, this king, this leader understood the spirit of this family. And so he says, verse 10, and now, behold, the children of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom thou wouldst not let Israel invade, when they came out of the land of Egypt, but they turned from them and destroyed them not. Behold, I say, how they reward us to come to cast us out of thy possession, which thou hast given us to inherit. O our God, wilt thou not judge them? For we have no might against this great company that cometh against us, neither know we what to do, but our eyes are upon thee. And so you see, Jehoshaphat understood the principle of the supremacy of God. He pleaded the divine help, not for their own salvation, but for the integrity and honor of God himself. For your sake, O God, you must act. For your honor, for your integrity, we depend upon you. For the honor of your name. That's a God-centered prayer. And anyone on that occasion that heard that prayer, that was of that mind and that heart, they must have rejoiced at the spirit of the king's prayer. And verse 13 says, and all Judah stood panim, in the presence of Yahweh, with their little ones and their wives and their children. And if all the congregation stood in the presence of God that day when that prayer was offered by this man, I think the house of Asaph would have absolutely been in the presence of God with the prayer of the king. Don't you think, brothers and sisters? And I know that's the case because, well, surprise, surprise, what do we find? Verse 14. Then after that prayer, upon Jahaziel, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benaiah, the son of Jael, the son of Mattaniah, a Levite of the sons of Asaph, came the Spirit of Yahweh in the midst of the congregation. A man of the sons of Asaph stood up. Now, isn't that interesting? And we said, did we not, that we believe a psalm was written at this very time of crisis by someone of the family of Asaph, and at the very moment of Jehoshaphat's prayer, a man in the house of Asaph stands up, Jahaziel, upon whom came the Spirit of God. And I think it wasn't just the Spirit of God that moved him, I think it was the Spirit of the king's prayer. And a man of the house of Asaph said, moved by that Spirit, he stood up, and this is what he said, verse 15. You see what it is that he did promise? He said, hearken ye, all Judah, and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem, and thou king, Jehoshaphat, thus saith Yahweh unto you, be not afraid, nor dismayed by reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. Tomorrow go ye down against them. Behold, they come up by the cliff of Ziz, and ye shall find them at the end of the brook before the wilderness of Jeruel. Ye shall not need to fight in this battle. Set yourselves, stand ye still, Exodus 14. See the salvation of Yahweh with you, O Judah and Jerusalem. Fear not, nor be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, for Yahweh will be with you. And the promise of Jahaziel was the promise to the nation of the presence of God, that presence would be with them in the time of this battle. God's presence shall be with you, cries a man of the house of Asaph in answer to the prayer of Jehoshaphat. And he answers as God's spokesman on this occasion. What a marvelous thing, brothers and sisters. What a marvelous thing. And the record says, verse 18, that when they heard that answer, that promise, that response from God through the mouth of a man of the house of Asaph, it says, verse 18, and Jehoshaphat bowed his head with his face to the ground, and all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem fell before Yahweh, worshipping Yahweh. Where does that spirit come from? Where does that solemnity and reverence come from? People that sing before God and bow their heads and fall to the ground prostrate before the God whom they serve. That's the spirit of the dedication of the temple in 2 Chronicles chapter 5. Here it is again. This is how they sang. This is how they responded. This is how they worshipped. Bowed heads, falling on their faces before Almighty God. And verse 19 says that others of the Levites, of the children of the Kohathites, and of the children of the Korahites, stood up to praise Yahweh Elohim of Israel with a loud voice on high when they heard that message from Jahaziel, who on this occasion was the very prophet of God in their midst. Others rejoiced at the answer that had come from God, and inspired by him, says verse 19, those of the Kohathites and those of the Korahites, who, by the way, were not singers because they were the sons of Korah, their role was to be the doorkeepers, not the singers, but even they on this occasion added their voices in praise at the wonder of God's answer through a man of the house of Asaph. And now verse 20 says, they rose early in the morning, and they went forth into the wilderness of Tekoa. And as they went forth, Jehoshaphat stood and said, hear me, O Judah, and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem. Believe in Yahweh your God, and so shall ye be established. Believe his prophets, and so shall ye prosper. Now, when Jehoshaphat said, believe in God, and in particular, believe in his prophets, what prophet do you think Jehoshaphat had in mind? And clearly in the context, the most immediate prophet was Jahaziel, a man of the house of Asaph, who had just prophesied that God's presence would be amongst them in this battle. Jehoshaphat stands up the next morning and he says, I want you to believe in the prophets of God. You believe in what Jahaziel has said. And if we do that, we shall all be well, says the king. And so the record says in verse 21, and when he had consulted with the people, actually the authorized version is slightly different to other translations. Jerusalem Bible says, then having held a conference with the people, but Rodham says, and when he'd given counsel unto the people. So I've got no doubt that the matter was discussed with the people, but I think that the initiative of verse 21 was actually the initiative of the king himself. It was Jehoshaphat's decision to do this, but he advised the people that it was his intention to do this thing. And what did he intend to do? Verse 21. He said he appointed singers unto Yahweh that would praise the beauty of holiness as they went before the army. Now, who might he choose, do you think, to sing in front of the army? Well, who sang in front of the rest of the congregation before the Ark of God's presence in Jerusalem at the temple? The house of Asaph. Who had prophesied on this occasion that God would be with them? A son of Asaph. Who might he set before the army now to sing the song as the army marched forth into battle? I think it was the house of Asaph that he would appoint on this occasion. Believe his prophets, verse 20, and ye shall prosper. And I think that we know that that's the case because, well, do you see what the record says? What song did the singers sing when they marched before the army in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 21? He appointed singers that should praise the beauty of holiness as they went out before the army, and this is what they sang. Praise Yahweh, for his mercy endureth forever. Now, where does that song come from, brothers and sisters? That's the first of Chronicles, chapter 16, and verse 34. Oh, give thanks unto Yahweh, for he is good, and for his mercy endureth forever. That's the family psalm son of the house of Asaph, these are the ones that stepped forth in front of the army, and they sang with the absolute conviction that God's presence would be with them. In fact, I think what we're being told is that when this family sang that psalm before the army, it was as if they were carrying the Ark of God with them. They marched in front of the army, and it's as if the Ark of God's presence was with them, in heart, in mind, and they sang with absolute assurance and confidence. What a remarkable moment this must have been. Can you ever imagine such a scene? An army with all of their shields and bows and swords, and right at the front of the army, a choir with their hymn books. This must have been an absolute astonishing scene to see. And the record says this, verse 22, "And when they began to sing and praise, Yahweh set ambushments against the children of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, which were come against Judah, and they were smitten." Verse 23, "For the children of Ammon and Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir utterly to slay and to destroy them. And when they'd made an end of the inhabitants of Seir, everyone helped," very kind of them, "to destroy another. And when Judah came toward the watchtower in the wilderness, they looked unto the multitude, and behold, they were dead bodies fallen to the earth, and none escaped." So just picture the scene. There's the army, all ready for battle. Here's the singers in front with their hymn books. Jehoshaphat said, "March!" And they began to march forward. The song of praise sung by the house of Asaph begins, "Oh, give thanks unto Yahweh, for he is good, and for his mercy endureth forever." The army fell behind. They marched to the battlefield, and when the hymn stopped, they all looked out, and the enemy was all dead before they'd even lifted a finger. It was the most astonishing story. When the song finished, the enemy was dead before the battle had even begun. Oh, and hold your hands in Chronicles. Come back to the first of Chronicles 16. Oh, wasn't this an appropriate psalm for them to sing in the context of this particular battle? First of Chronicles 16, the family psalm. "Oh, give thanks unto Yahweh, for he is good, and for his mercy endureth forever." Now see what the psalm does say in verse 34 of first of Chronicles 16. They marched before the army, and this is what it says. "Oh, give thanks unto Yahweh, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever. And say ye, save us, O God of our salvation, and gather us together, and deliver us from the heathen, that we may give thanks to thy holy name and glory in thy praise." Oh, look at the appropriateness of that psalm as they went into battle. It was the very thing that they should have sung. "Save us from the heathen. Deliver us from the heathen, so that we may give thanks to thy holy name and glory in thy praise." Oh yes, I think that psalm was exactly the psalm they should have sung, the song they should and did in fact sing. See what it says back in 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 22. See, the record says this. It says, "When they began to sing and praise, then Yahweh set ambushments." So what we're being told is that when their spirit was right, and when they sang that hymn with absolute focus before God, then God moved on their behalf. And this must be one of the most unique chapters when you think about it in Bible history, that on this occasion, on this day, a group of singers won a battle. What sort of music vanquishes an army? Well, this song did on this day. And it must have been one of the most glorious occasions, as it were, in the history of the nation, when this family stepped up on behalf of the needs of the nation and marched in front of an army to sing their praises. And I think there's a lesson, you see, that comes out of this story this day, in the time of Solomon and in the time of Jehoshaphat. This 100 years, although separated in time, and although separated by perhaps several generations of the family, the spirit in the days of Solomon and the spirit of this family in the days of Jehoshaphat was in fact absolutely identical. They sang the same song, they sang the same psalm. and they certainly had the same spirit. They were so overcome with the thought of ascribing praise to God that they worshipped with bowed heads. Now here's the lesson from our story this morning, or at least one of them. And it is an important one. Sacred music is different to secular music. Do you know in the Bible the sacred instruments were kept apart from other instruments and they were only ever used for temple worship? The cymbal, the psaltery, the harp, and the trumpet. They were dedicated for the worship and praise of God. They were kept apart. Perhaps even the sound of the instruments was different. Now the fact is that the Bible mentions a number of other musical instruments. The dulcimer, the timbrel, the sackbut, the drum, the tabret, the cornet, the pipe, the viol. There's lots of other musical instruments that the Bible mentions, but none of them were ever to be found, ever to be heard in the songs of the temple. And I think one of the reasons were that some of those musical instruments were associated with the pagan music of the Gentile nations around about them. God did not permit those in his sanctuary. The only instruments that God permitted, the only music that God permitted, was in fact organized by himself, including even the instruments themselves. They were holy and they were spiritual. And those instruments, whatever sound they made, and we haven't got one to know, but we can be absolutely certain that whatever range of emotions those instruments conveyed, they did so in a manner that was consistent with the requirements of Almighty God himself. In fact, we have good evidence that David received the shape and the pattern of those instruments by divine revelation. He made them by divine inspiration. God said, "I will tell you how these instruments will be made, and no other instrument, the sound of any other instrument, will not be heard in my sanctuary before the ark of my presence." We need to think about the implications of that. That separation of secular and sacred. Now, the reality is that in our own songs of praise, we've got to be able to convey a whole range of emotions, do we not? Majesty and mercy, grandeur and goodness, dignity and pathos, contentment and peace, sadness and love, sternness and joy, happiness and reverence, compassion and thanksgiving, sorrow and praise. They're all there in our hymns, and they need to be. But you see, one can be solemn and joyful. One can exult with praise, but still be reverent. One can be glad, but still maintain the dignity of God's honor. And the key to the songs of the house of Asaph were that their sense of dignity and reverence in praise was never lost and never forgotten. The world has lost it. And so have the churches. And so has modern Christian music. And that Christian music is infiltrating into our own community, and it's wrong. And the reason why it's wrong is because the critical thing about modern church and Christian music is that it's devoted to the importance of the music and not the importance of the words. And so the question we've got to ask is the focus of this piece on the music or on the words? What thinkest thou? In fact, I believe that I could probably tell you by looking at some hymns whether the words were written first or the music. And if the music was written first, I can tell you that it's already the wrong way. Because when you write music, because you like the beat and you like the rhythm, and then you try and find some spiritual words, even some biblical words, to try and match that tune, you've already done the wrong thing. You've crossed the invisible boundary. It began with the words, not the tune. We've got all the psalms of the house of Asaph, all the words, none of the music. God hasn't preserved the music. He's left the words, because the words are what bring us into the presence of God. And we want to avoid what the world is doing. We want to make sure that our songs of worship are not modeled on modern secular sound or modern secular rhythm. We want to avoid them. And there's music within our community that does exactly that. It sounds exactly like modern secular music. Exactly. The only thing that's different is the words. But if you didn't know what the words were, you could have thought that it was a modern popular love song or even a country and western piece of music. That's not what preserves and guards the heritage of the solemnity of worship that this house, this family had when they bowed before God, even with their faces to the ground and their songs of praise. Whatever their music was, it never ever was at the expense of that principle of solemnity. So we want to avoid that which is frivolous or foolish. We want to avoid that which is familiar or casual. We want to avoid that which is flippant or showy in our music and in our songs of praise. What the churches have done is they've developed a genre of music that emulates and copies and mimics the world where God is the bloke next door and Christ is our boyfriend, and we don't want it, brothers and sisters. We don't want it. That does not guard the heritage of the truth. So here's the golden rule. As the strength of the beat increases, reverence declines. We need to think about that. In terms of the moment when those two things cross over and work against each other. So here's the lesson from our study this morning. It's the study, it's the principle of solemnity of worship. Where do you think this began? You see, after the first disastrous attempt to bring the ark to Jerusalem, all Israel knew the power of him that dwelleth between the cherubim. By the flashing forth of the divine majesty and judgment, Yahweh signified that mere feeling and enthusiasm and worship were not enough. All they sang before God with all their might on the day that Uzzah was killed, but it wasn't correct. It wasn't consistent with God's standard. And he said that his divine principles must be upheld and the majesty of his holiness honored by the singing of psalms before him in the solemnity of worship. David learnt that lesson. He never forgot it. I think that's partly why he chose Asaph, to guard something that he himself had momentarily forgotten. You see, the splendor of the divine glory in approval was such an awe-inspiring sight that the whole congregation were prostrated to the ground in humility. You see, that governs the type of song that we would sing. For that spirit to be evoked in our midst, some music will be absolutely inconsistent with that spirit of reverence and humility. And if that's how the congregation were, you can imagine what the singers were like. The singers, imbued with thoughts that exalt the supremacy of God, sang their praises with gladness and yet with solemn reverence, worshipping with bowed heads, even as they sang, says the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 29 and verse 30. And so the lesson therefore is this, that the house of Asaph stood in awe of God's presence in their midst. And so in their songs, that which was familiar or casual, flippant or frivolous, was totally avoided. Their music, however joyful, was never at the expense of the reverence and dignity appropriate in praising God in the solemnity of worship. That's one of the benchmarks of this family. We would do well to remember it, brothers and sisters, and young people, in guarding the heritage of the house of Asaph.